It is Monday, April the 16th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, did Saturday's strikes interrupt Syria's chemical weapons capabilities?
The buildings themselves were destroyed, so that may retard Syria's ability to use chemical weapons.
U.S. North Korea summit looms.
Clearly, North Korea is trying to line up and show support from both China and Russia, its traditional patrons, in advance of that meeting with Donald Trump.
Also ahead, the March for Science, social media trends, and the sounds of Sade. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned further Western attacks on Syria would bring chaos to world affairs. He also spoke with Iranian President Hassan Rouhani, who basically agreed with him. The strikes have interrupted any immediate chance of getting a political settlement to Syria's civil war. Putin's warning came as Washington prepared to increase pressure on Russia with new economic sanctions. The U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, told the CBS program Face the Nation the United States will announce additional sanctions today.
So you will see that Russian sanctions will be coming down, and they will go directly to any sort of companies that were dealing with equipment related to Assad and chemical weapons use. And so I think everyone is going to feel it at this point. I think everyone knows that we sent a strong message, and our hope is that they listen to it.
On Saturday, the United States, France, and Britain launched 105 missiles, all of those directed at Syria. General Joseph Dunford, Jr. is chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, which include the chiefs of the U.S. Army and the Air Force, the commandant of the U.S. Marine Corps, and the chief of U.S. Naval Operations. He named the sites in Syria that were targets for Saturday's strikes.
The first target was a scientific research center located in the greater Damascus area. This military facility was a Syrian center for the research, development, production, and testing of chemical and biological warfare technology. The second target was a chemical weapons storage facility west of Homs. We assessed that this was the primary location of Syrian sarin and precursor production equipment. The third target, which was in the vicinity of the second target, contained both a chemical weapons equipment storage facility and an important command post.
Strikes on these locations by the U.S., Britain, and France were in retaliation for a suspected poison attack in the Syrian city of Douma on April the 7th, leaving at least 40 dead there. Many parties have blamed the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad for the alleged attack in Douma. For some perspective on all of this, including the messages coming from Moscow and Tehran about the strikes interrupting a political settlement to Syria's civil war, VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with Trinity University scholar David Lesh, who says it's all a lot of hyperbole.
Going was very, very tough to get a political settlement even before the strikes, and now they have a convenient scapegoat to blame the lack of progress on a political settlement by blaming the United States for upsetting the balance of power and bringing, as Putin said, more chaos into Syria that prevents any momentum toward a political settlement. But it wasn't really happening anyway for a whole host of other reasons. So I really don't buy the Russian president's argument.
The U.S. U.N. ambassador on Sunday television suggested that the U.S. is about to impose new economic sanctions targeting companies, including Russian companies, apparently, that deal with equipment related to the Syrian Assad alleged chemical weapons use. More sanctions, the answer?
Well, I think there seems to be an increasing pattern of late in terms of anti-Russian measures. Earlier related to the poisoning of the ex-Russian spy in Britain, as well as Russia not being able to contain their client in Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. So I think obviously pressure on Bashar al-Assad hasn't worked in terms of either bringing him to the negotiating table and making real concessions, or obviously in stopping the use of chemical weapons. And so perhaps more pressure on Russia and particular Russian oligarchs, and it seems to be hurting, that will in turn compel them to, restrain their client.
105 missiles fired by the UK, France, and the U.S. At targets related to the chemical weapons infrastructure in Syria. How effective was that strike, do you think?
Probably not too effective, since they had a week, you know, heads up from the United States that something was going to happen. So, you know, of course, they were dispersing their what remains of the Syrian Air Force to Russian bases, and they probably knew that their chemical weapons facilities, their research and development center and storage areas were going to be hit, and so they probably transferred that material. You know, as far as infrastructure being hit, you know, the buildings themselves were destroyed, so that may retard Syria's ability to use chemical weapons. But I think it was mostly a message being sent. And, you know, this attack, as opposed to the one a year ago, was multinational. It was a little bit more intense, obviously. And the message being sent is, you know, President Assad, if you use them again, or if it's shown that you use them again, the next strike will even be more intense. So it seems to be a gradual upping of the ante against Assad, and hoping that, you know, the threshold has been reached. But from Assad's perspective, you know, again, he probably sees this as, you know, something of a slap in the wrist, especially since he had such advance notice. Whether or not it will stop the use of chemical weapons, maybe in the near term. I think one of the problems in this situation right now is that the Syrian government thinks it's operating under an Iranian and Russian defense umbrella, and so they probably think they have a lot more flexibility than they actually have, and therefore perhaps got a little complacent in terms of what they think they can get away with, and used you know, allegedly used the chemical weapons last week. Whereas Russia certainly, and the Iranians certainly, don't want the Syrian regime to do anything that could bring the U.S. back into the equation more than they already are, especially after President Trump said a couple of weeks ago that he wanted to get out. So I think that's the last thing that the Russians want. And I'm fairly certain that despite the animus from Tehran and from Moscow against the United States, that if, in fact, the Assad regime did carry out this chemical weapons attack, that they're equally upset at Damascus for, you know, providing a ready excuse for the U.S. to intervene.
A team of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons is on the ground, hoping to begin to investigate the suspected attack of chemical weapons in Douma. Do you think at this stage they'll be able to find anything? Is it too late?
Usually they can find something. It just depends on the chemical weapon that was used. Apparently, chlorine, there are some suggestions of sarin, but based on what people and those in the medical community have been reading from the online photographs and videos taken of those that suffered from the attack, it seems to be chlorine, which was actually not included in the chemical weapons that needed to be removed in the 2013 agreement, but still obviously prohibited in international law. Now that these weapons inspectors or chemical weapons inspectors will be carefully monitored by Syrian security.
That's David Lesh. He is a distinguished professor of Middle East history at Trinity University. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un warmly greeted over the weekend Chinese senior diplomat Song Tao and a Chinese delegation, including a Chinese art troupe led by Song. He also expressed his greetings to Chinese President Xi Jinping after Song conveyed Xi's greetings to Kim, all of this following last month's visit to Beijing by Kim. VOA asked Korea Society Senior Director Stephen Norbert if this is a sign of warming relations between North Korea and China.
We've had several years of very bad relations between China and North Korea, and up until Kim Jong-un's visit to Xi Jinping in Beijing, there had not been a visit between the two. However, clearly this is intended to show some warming. Kim Jong-un sent a congratulatory message to Xi after the Party Congress in which Xi consolidated his power and began his second term. So it clearly this is a strategy to show a warmer relationship between the two, and from Kim Jong-un's perspective, probably well in advance of the meeting with Donald Trump, trying to show some leverage and other major power support.
And could all of this lead to some sort of agreement over North Korea's nuclear program when President Trump goes to Pyongyang?
Well, I think it's good news in a primary sense of the fact that North Korea now has more skin in the game, meaning it has more obligation to make the summit happen and to try to maximize the results of it, because it has gone now to China now sending this type of delegation back, and there appears to be a warming of ties. Also, the North Korean foreign minister was in Moscow meeting with the Russian foreign minister. So clearly, North Korea is trying to line up and show support from both China and Russia, its traditional patrons, in advance of that meeting with Donald Trump.
Stephen Norbert serves as Korea Society's Senior Director for Policy and as an adjunct fellow with the Pacific Forum.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News.
The second annual March for Science was held on the National Mall here in Washington over the weekend, and more than 200 similar events were held around the world. Organizers say the march took place after a turbulent year in science policy with the current U.S. administration and around the world, for that matter. VOA's Steve Barragona has more.
Chris Zarba retired from the Environmental Protection Agency this February. After 38 years at EPA, he says the Trump administration has been different from any he's seen.
I think across the boards we've seen a real sidelining of science.
As the Trump administration undoes what it calls job-killing regulations on climate change, water pollution, pesticides, and more, Zarba says industry has a voice, but science does not. Fear that science would be sidelined is why scientists took to the streets a year ago. March for Science co-organizer Caroline Weinberg.
There's been a real wave of science advocacy, and I think that what the March for Science the first time around did was bring that to the forefront of the public's attention, that there are all these people like ready to mobilize around something so important.
And she says scientists have remained mobilized in the year since the march. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
This year, March for Science organizers rallied support to lift a ban on gun violence research. Caroline Weinberg said they debated whether the issue was too partisan for the group to weigh in on, but they decided that it was more important to support research than would help policymakers make good decisions. It is time now for VOA's Lori London to join us with what's trending on social media. What you got, Lori?
Well, Steve, an incident captured on cell phone video at a Starbucks coffee shop in Philadelphia has gone viral, and it's creating a life of its own, as many things do with controversial issues in the age of social media. So cell phone footage from onlookers, customers filming this incident, shows two men sitting quietly at a table at this Starbucks talking for several minutes to police officers who have apparently been called to the store, and they're then put in handcuffs and marched out. Now, other customers, including a middle-aged white man, are trying to intervene. The white man tells police the pair have done nothing wrong, that they're allowed to be there, and that the officers are only trying to remove them because they're black, which an officer denies. The incident drew protests outside the coffee shop, with people holding signs saying things like, "Coffee is black," and "arrested for being black." And as you can imagine, lots and lots of talk on social media about it. One eyewitness who took to Twitter said, quote, "People are saying there must be more to this story. There isn't. This would never happen to someone who looks like me. People don't believe black people when they say this stuff happens. It does. They want to know extenuating circumstances. There are none. And we will also tell you Starbucks has apologized to the two individuals and its customers for what took place. And in a statement, CEO Kevin Johnson writes, "We regret that our practices and training led to the reprehensible outcome at our Philadelphia store. We are taking immediate action to learn from this and be better." But again, the power of social media to get a message out. This went on someone's cell phone video and went online and immediately went viral and created outrage. And also, Steve, we've got some sad news. The other big talk on social media is about former First Lady Laura Bush. A family spokesman issued a statement Sunday saying, quote, "Following a recent series of hospitalizations and after consulting her family and doctors, Mrs. Bush, now age 92, has decided not to seek additional medical treatment and will instead focus on comfort care. It will not surprise those who know her that Barbara Bush has been a rock in the face of her failing health, worrying not for herself, thanks to her abiding faith, but for others. She is surrounded by a family she adores and appreciates the many kind messages and especially the prayers she is receiving." Now, Bush is the only woman, by the way, besides Abigail Adams, to be both a wife and a mother to a president of the United States. She's well known for a lot of things. She's married to George H.W. Bush, the nation's 41st president, known for her white hair and her triple-strand fake pearl necklace. And as you can imagine, there have been many, many, many well wishes on social media and prayers from famous names like Chelsea Clinton and Meghan McCain and President Trump's press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, as well as thousands of ordinary Americans saying, regardless of politics, that she's a role model and a class act known for her spunk, her strength, love of her family, and for the country. Steve?
Many thanks to you, Lori. VOA's Lori London. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
We've heard from various studies that drinking a glass of wine a day or any alcoholic beverage in moderation can lower risks of serious illnesses such as cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, and even gallstones. But a new study from the UK's University of Cambridge is contradicting those findings. The paper, published in The Lancet, suggests that weekly drinking of more than 5 pints of beer, 5 glasses of wine, or 5 drinks with a maximum of 100 grams of pure alcohol was linked with a lower life expectancy. The study authors found drinking any more than what was suggested increases the risk of stroke, fatal aneurysm, heart failure, and even death. Researchers suggest having 10 to 18 drinks each week lessens life expectancy by between 1 to 2 years, and 18 drinks or more shortens life expectancy from 4 to 5 years. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Now it's time for a little something from the world of music. Helen Fola Sade Adu, professionally known as Sade, is a Nigerian-British singer, songwriter, composer, arranger, and record producer. She gained worldwide fame as the lead vocalist of the English band Sade. Following a record deal with Epic Records, the band released their debut album in 1984, selling more than 6 million copies. And like the hit songs on that album, there have always been big hits for Sade, like By Your Side. You're lost, you're alone, you can't get back again. I will find Sade was also an actor for a while, debuting in the British film Absolute Beginners. That was in 1986. But writing songs and singing them before large concerts worldwide has been the bulk of Sade's career. In the U.S. alone, record sales exceed 23 million. A Wrinkle in Time is an American science fantasy adventure film directed by Ava DuVernay, starring Oprah Winfrey, Reese Witherspoon, and Storm Reid, who plays a young girl who, with the help of several astral travelers, sets off on a quest to find her father, who went missing after discovering a new planet. Sade was tapped to write the song Flower of the Universe for the film's soundtrack.
They come to see a fire burning in your heart. They want to witness this love.
Debut album Diamond Life in 1984, Sade and Ray St. John wrote Smooth Operator, which became Sade's first top 10 hit in the U.S. and remains one of her most popular songs.
That I don't hear that on the radio. How about you, huh? Almost all the time on lots of playlists. Super duper Smooth Operator from Sade. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. The latest world news is just around the corner. Hope you'll stay tuned for that. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a super Monday. And now a bit more from Sade.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In November 1993, David Ngeli became the first Motswana to openly disclose he was living with HIV. Over the past 25 years, more courageous individuals have followed him in making public disclosures, though they represent a small percentage of the estimated 360,000 Botswana who are living with HIV. Many of those who have publicly disclosed their HIV status in Botswana have stated that the virus has been less oppressive than the stigma attached to it. While public displays of stigma and discrimination are not as frequent and visible as in years past, many people have endured the incredibly painful experience of being stigmatized because of their HIV status, often by the same family and friends whom they look to for love and acceptance. In order to support these brave men and women, PEPFAR, the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, has funded BONEPWA Plus to implement the Treat All Champions campaign. The campaign has enlisted 30 people living openly with HIV to mobilize their communities to address stigma and other barriers that prevent Botswana from knowing their status or enrolling on life-saving antiretroviral treatment if they are diagnosed with HIV. Through the Treat All strategy, launched by President Khama in 2016, all Botswana living with HIV now have the opportunity to enroll in antiretroviral treatment immediately upon their diagnosis. Over the past 15 years, the U.S. government, through PEPFAR, has not only saved and improved millions of lives, but has also transformed the global HIV/AIDS response. Through PEPFAR's strategy for accelerating HIV/AIDS epidemic control, as many as 13 countries, including Botswana, could achieve epidemic control by 2020. Since 2004, PEPFAR has supported the government of Botswana with $950 million for HIV prevention, treatment, and care. PEPFAR is also implementing specific strategies to address the largest gaps in the HIV response, primarily in reaching youth aged 15 to 24 and men aged over 30. The United States is proud to partner with Botswana and more than 50 other countries toward controlling and ultimately ending their HIV/AIDS epidemics.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Thank you.
problem.